The Formal Workplace Inclusion's 2022 podcast series is sponsored by Best Buy. More diversity in tech means more ideas that can change the world. Learn more at bestbuy.com/more of this. We get to engage people, advance ideas, and ignite change because of the generous support from our community. If you find our resources meaningful or valuable, please consider supporting the forum today. Visit forumworkplaceinclusion.org/donate. That's forumworkplaceinclusion.org/donate. Thank you very much for your support and generosity. And thank you all to our listeners and subscribers. You help support the growth of the podcast and reach new listeners. If you like what you're hearing on the Forum podcast, please consider writing a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you've already written a review, thank you. And please consider sharing our podcast with a friend, family member, or a colleague you think might find value in the content. Word of mouth is the best way the forum grows. So thank you very much for listening and sharing. Thanks again, and enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. It's Lisa Russell, co-founder and CEO of Alaria. I am so excited to be back on the Forum on Workplace Inclusions podcast. Today, I have also invited a really good friend to join me for this conversation. For those of you who don't already know her, I am thrilled to introduce to you Alexis Gonzalez Black. She's the org design practice lead for August Public and an expert in org design, change management, and the future of work. And I honestly can't think of a better person to discuss this topic with me today. So, hey, Alexis.
Hi, Lisa. Excited to be here with you today and looking forward to the topic. I won't spoil it. I'll let you get to it and introduce it in a second. But a little bit of my background is that I was the org design lead at Zappos when we implemented something called Holacracy, which was a radical management experiment that got rid of titles and distributed decision making into the company. So that was a really formative experience for me. I went on to be a design lead at the global design firm IDEO, where I worked in the San Francisco office for several years. And now I'm a partner at August, doing decision making and org design.
Amazing. And on our side, as many of you know, at Alaria, we focus on measuring inclusion in the workplace. We're coming into organizations like yours and helping to uncover how exactly you can meaningfully invest in DEI and diversity and inclusion efforts. And we're able to do that by collecting hundreds and sometimes thousands of experiences from employees across an organization. And oftentimes our team's looking to understand from those experiences, like, what are these moments that are making folks feel excluded or included on a day-to-day basis? You know, we're typically organizing and analyzing those moments really to try to get context in terms of, like, where are the opportunities? How do we drive change? And we're doing that through the lens of a framework that we've created. It's called the Categories of Inclusion, but we won't focus on that too deeply today, mostly because the topic today, decision-making, doesn't fall easily into one of those categories. The reality is that decision-making is being made in the workplace every single day across the organization. And decision-making impacts both the company and the employees in so many different ways.
Yes, I sort of hinted at this earlier, but decision-making is one of my areas of expertise, and it's something that I've been really focused on since the beginning of my career, because it is such a powerful proxy for so many different dynamics that are happening in an organization. So when you study decision-making, you are also studying how power and authority and structure shows up in that organization. You're studying psychological safety and trust. You're studying all kinds of dimensions of relationship and the strength of relationship and how that shows up in this pivotal moment of making decisions and moving the organization forward. So I'm a big fan of looking further into decision making, because I think it can tell you a lot about the culture of teams and the culture of organizations.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. For the context of this conversation, and of course, out of pure curiosity, I went ahead and had our team look at our data set. So, you know, as I mentioned, we have all of these experiences that we've collected from employees that are describing moments that made them feel excluded. And so we have this data set that spans over, you know, well over 4 years of different moments across organizations globally. And when we dug into the data, we were able to kind of take a look and see, like, what is actually causing folks to feel excluded as it relates to decision making? And how does that, you know, make sense in the context of, you know, our DEI initiatives that we're so used to investing in? And where can we really invest in change as it relates to these types of experiences, right? So all this to say, our company dug in and we were looking at what is common, like where are folks being made to feel excluded as it relates to decision-making? And importantly, you know, how is it impacting their sense of inclusion, the employee's individual sense of inclusion in the workplace? And in the context of the categories of inclusion, our framework, we're seeing that the majority of those experiences relate to access and to skills use. And so, you know, as an example, we can see that employees are often feeling like they're being left out of decisions that impact their roles or their responsibilities. Or we're seeing that within an organization, folks aren't leveraging their expertise, their skill set. They're not being leveraged to make more informed decisions, right? So it's that access to the decision-making process, that ability to participate in that process, and the ability to leverage their skills and expertise in making decisions in an organization. So what this tells me, the data as a whole here, as we're looking at decision-making related data, is that organizations really have an opportunity to increase the sense of inclusion by allowing their employees to participate in the decision-making process. And not only to participate, but to experience or to leverage their experiences and their expertise to make sure that they actually feel like they're being leveraged and valued in that decision-making process.
Yeah, this definitely reflects what I see when I'm working in organizations. One of the big stories that we hear over and over again are these huge career-changing decisions that seem to appear out of nowhere, just coming out from the leadership team. And, you know, large swaths of the organization, whether it's the sales team or the marketing organization, has had some really impactful decision happen to them, not with them. So that kind of theme of being excluded or just on being on the receiving end of decisions is definitely resonates with my experience in organizations. And the other thing that you shared is about, you know, people feeling like their expertise or their, you know, their perspective isn't being valued. And again, that's something we see all the time. When leaders are making decisions, they're typically relying on a small subset of what we call kind of like their superheroes, like the people that they go to over and over again for thought partnership to help them drive forward decisions. And it's sort of out of habit that we, you know, assemble the same group over and over again, rather than taking a beat to notice, like, are there other perspectives, either perspectives that are closer to the work or perspectives that might be impacted by this decision that I should include at the decision-making table? So definitely, you know, seeing that all across the board as folks are making decisions, that a little bit of intentionality in those moments can make a world of difference to the feeling of inclusion.
Yeah, it's refreshing to hear that you're seeing the same thing that we seem to be reading from our data. That's always good. And I think that one of the things that's interesting as we're, you know, in this work and we're actively trying to drive change in organizations is that we have to make it something that individuals within the organization, you know, whether it's individual employees, managers, leadership teams, they're sitting here listening to us saying, yeah, but like, what do I do about this? Like, how can I know where to drive change in my organization? How do I know if we have a poor decision-making culture? So yeah. I'm curious from your perspective, like what are the signs of a poor decision-making culture and what should people be looking for?
Yeah, well, we've already covered some of them. And one is if you're looking at your, you know, engagement results, you're looking at a study, you're definitely going to notice folks feeling like they've been excluded from major decisions or that decisions aren't being communicated. Sometimes this comes across with the label of transparency. Like we're not, this organization is not transparent about what is happening. Another sort of thing that you can see is that growing frustration with how slow or cumbersome decision-making processes are. That is a refrain that we hear over and over again in organizations that struggle, which is like, you know, we're seeking consensus. It takes us so long to move something forward. And by the time we move something forward, it's not even relevant anymore. You know, like the world moves fast nowadays. We have to be able to keep pace with, you know, information and with shifting circumstances around us. And that is definitely not what is happening in a lot of organizations. So I definitely, you know, you're going to see people talking about transparency. You're going to see people talking about feeling stymied or stuck or blocked in critical places of work, you'll hear that refrain about empowerment. Like, I should be more empowered. I'm the expert here. So those, you know, along with everything that you said, are definitely signals that you can be tuned into to see, you know, how your team feels about decision making.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's interesting because I think that so often when we're thinking about who's making decisions and like who has that authority and who's telling us like how quickly to move on things, it really comes down to leadership. And it's not that we all don't influence decisions or have the ability to, or that we don't have decisions that we're making in our own role every single day, but there's an outweighted, you know, kind of like attribution here. Yeah. And our data set also kind of supports that. When we were looking at all of the different experiences that came up, and related to decision-making specifically, we saw that over 73% of all of those experiences were attributed to leadership as a source. Yes. And so, you know, when we're saying, what can we do to drive change here? What can we do to make folks feel included in the decision-making process? We really have to start with leadership, it seems, but I'm curious what you think there and whether or not you feel like leadership is the best place to start.
Totally. I guess the first thing I would say is I want to level with leaders. If you're listening to this podcast, I want to just like share with you this sort of mantra or saying that we use when we talk about decision making, which is we have to accept that 100% certainty is a fantasy. Once we accept that we are operating in a volatile, complex, ambiguous world, and that 100% certainty, especially as we are working on projects that are about innovation or pushing the edge of the capabilities of our organization, once we admit that it is impossible for us to know the exact right answer, we are then liberated to make decisions in such a more agile, effective and efficient way. And so I want to urge leaders, like, I know that you've been hired into leadership because you have been able to, in some ways, create that idea of certainty in your team that, like, I can control this, I can keep us on track. And when I talk to leaders one-on-one, almost always there's this admission of, I don't actually know what's happening. I don't have control over it. I'm totally overwhelmed. There's imposter syndrome. So I just want to encourage our leaders, first of all, affirm that, yes, I think leadership is the right place to start because naturally they hold a lot of the leadership just from the position that they hold. And also that that mindset of better decision-making and making smaller, faster, more efficient, more agile decisions, it really begins with modeling from you and you admitting that 100% certainty is a fantasy. In the world where that's a fantasy, I am more liberated to distribute decision-making authority to my team in meaningful ways. We are more empowered to take steps forward, even if we're not sure, to learn and to generate data and to generate information. So I would just say, yes, start with leaders, and it begins with adopting that mindset.
Yeah, that I love that. I feel like every day I need to be reminded that, like, just stop it with the perfectionism. Like, certainty is not a thing for sure. Move on with the decision, but also listen to folks, like, you know, get feedback on that decision. Yes. In the process. And I think there's a lot of themes already kind of popping up so far. You know, we're talking about power, we're talking about transparency and communication. Yeah. This idea of ambiguity is an interesting one. We certainly saw that. Yeah. Pop up around folks feeling excluded just because they weren't even sure how decisions got made, or like, yeah, not being communicated. Yes. Around, like, what is the process here? Am I being left out? Is this normal? And I think that, like, communication is clearly an opportunity area here.
Totally. And I don't want to interrupt you if you're going to finish a thought.
No worries. I think I was just trying to, process the idea and the opportunity for leaders here. But I think one other thing that I'm seeing in our data is because not only are we looking at experiences of inclusion, but we're often layering diversity data on top of that. And so beyond just looking at positions within an organization, yeah, it's important for us to look at, are there folks within an organization that are having a different experience as a result of their own identity? And I do think that as is the case with many organizational processes and practices and experiences, our identities are coming into play. And so we're seeing that in the data. You know, we're seeing folks say things like, you know, I'm on a male dominated team who regularly speaks over me. And so I'm not feeling heard. My perspective isn't being valued because it's not being heard. Things like I'm so, you know, I'm younger than the average person on my team. And so I'm not seen as being a credible expert among my peers, things like this, that really kind of demonstrate how bias is coming into that decision-making process. But I'm curious how you're seeing it creep in and what suggestions you have for folks there.
Yeah, I'm going to touch a little bit on the leadership piece as we close that up. And then I will talk about bias for sure. But one thing I wanted to say that sparked for me as you were talking is that because we don't treat decision-making as a skill that can be learned, we sort of assume that leaders have it, and we leave it up to them to kind of figure out how to develop those skills through the course of their career. We borrow a lot of our decision-making skills from sort of politicking and consensus seeking and just kind of like the default decision-making methods of organizations. And so I think it's really important to see decision-making for what it is. It's a skill that needs to be taught and it needs to be learned. And so, you know, when we're talking about making the kind of ambiguous decision-making process more explicit, I think that's the first step, is capturing what is the process that we are adhering to, and how do we upskill people and build capacity to use and leverage that process so it becomes a trusted part of our organization that people can rely on to be fair, to be inclusive, rather than this kind of like implicit, you know, gray area that like some people are gifted in decisions and some people aren't. I think we just need to get rid of that notion and just realize that decision making is a skill that we all have to learn, that we have to capture explicitly and have to learn.
Okay, so you mentioned that decision-making is really a skill, which makes a lot of sense, particularly in the context of leadership and everything that we're seeing in our data set. But I'm curious from your perspective, aside from, you know, hiring you all and bringing them into to help them with their decision-making processes and practices, what is something, or how do people go about practicing that skill? Like where do they go? Where do they begin?
Yeah, I think the first thing to do is what your company does, which is to begin by asking the members of your team, like, how satisfied with you are you with the culture of decision making on our team, or what holds us back from being better decision makers? That way you can begin to sort of heat map what are the specific barriers or challenges that your team has. Is it transparency? Is it empowerment? Is it communicating about decisions? So, you know, being able to calibrate, like, where do we need to get better in decision making? The next step I would suggest is just mapping your decision-making process. So you could use a scenario that your team has just recently gone through where you've had to make a high-stakes decision or a decision that was particularly cross-functional. So a decision that kind of stands out and kind of case study it, right? Map it out. How did we begin? Who did we invite into the room? What process did we use? Who did we communicate with? And begin to sort of write down what it looked like. And then you can identify what are the points where we could improve this process and really star those and say, okay, at this point, we had one meeting, but we didn't invite the right people. So then we ended up having to have a second meeting. So being able to just really make the process that you're using currently explicit and capture it allows you to kind of step back and say, okay, I can begin to see how we can improve this. And then the last thing I would suggest is just, you know, definitely reading about decision-making methods. A lot of times, if you think about decision-making kind of as a spectrum, so if you close your eyes and you imagine a spectrum, at one end of the spectrum, you have like individual decision-making, which is like command and control. I'm in charge. I make the call decision-making. On the other far end of the spectrum, you have consensus, which is everybody has to agree before we move forward. And a lot of times we sort of pendulum swing back and forth between these two types of decision-making methods without recognizing that there are a host of decision-making methodologies that sit in the middle of that spectrum. And so you can use something like an advice process, which is, look, I'm the decision owner. I'm going to share a proposal with the team. I'm going to, you know, get a round of advice from each member of the team. And then I'm going to follow up with the decision that I made. Right? So it's not total command and control. You are making sure you hear from each person individually in an uninterrupted way. And then there's obviously democratic decision-making, which is voting and, you know, 2/3 or 50%, you know, wins. And there are also other decision-making processes, one that we call consent, which is searching for an absence of objections. So instead of saying, does everybody agree to this? Does everybody like this? Is everybody into it? Which are those kind of consensus seeking behaviors, asking, hey, does anybody have any information or data that this is unsafe to try? So really farming for objections, farming for dissent, getting that out on the table. So I would just, you know, approach decision-making that way, Google decision-making methods, educate yourself on different ways of approaching decisions that are more inclusive and better suited to the decisions that you're making.
Wow. I feel like I also will need to be doing that. I haven't read enough on decision-making, clearly. I also find it interesting. I love the case study idea. And I think one aspect of it that's particularly interesting to me is that just by the simple practice of having to document or discuss what occurred will also yes. surface so many different perspectives of like how decisions were made and yes. how things actually unfolded. And I imagine that even just having that forced conversation of having to, you know, even document the perspective of how these decisions were made would be a very interesting and worthwhile, you know, kind of experience.
Totally.
And I want to circle back, you know, get us back to something else that I brought up earlier, which is the idea of, you know, how is bias creeping into the decision-making process?
Yeah.
So
yes.
let's say that we've done our homework. We have, you know, decided this is how we're going to make this really big decision in our organization. We're going to give this a go, this new practice we just learned about. You know, how do we also make sure that we're not allowing bias to creep into that process?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, decision making, like any other process, has many opportunities where bias can creep in. I like to think about them as like cracks that like let bias sort of seep into the process. And the way that we can address those cracks is by developing and capturing a trusted decision making system that has pauses along the way where we check ourselves for bias. So, for example, at the beginning of a decision making process, so let's say you notice like, oh, we're trying to make a decision here. The next natural thing to do is to ask like who needs to be in the room to make this decision and do a little stakeholder mapping. And this is the first place where there can be a lot of bias that creeps in. Earlier, we talked about a leader relying on their superstars, their, you know, go-to group of people. And how can you pause in that moment to check, to ask yourself, are there any other perspectives that need to be represented at this table? What exactly is the decision we're making and who has the best data for that? Rather than thinking about like, who do I like to talk to? Who's going to make me feel good about this decision, which is the sort of, you know, bias that a lot of people are going into this with, asking yourself, who has the best data? Who has the best proximity? Who's going to be impacted by this decision? And more thoughtfully creating a stakeholder map.
Yeah, I find that oftentimes when creating that stakeholder list, it's like the gut default is like, who's going to make this easy for me? You know, who's not going to disagree with me? And that's such a hard thing to like personally fight, but I think it's super important as well.
Yes. And we have to flip that, because what happens is that we make that decision in that like comfortable womb of like friendly faces. And then we announce it to the rest of the organization and we're surprised when everybody is mad because they didn't have any idea. So which brings me to my second point where I think bias can creep in is I think the way that I approach decision-making is default to open and default to public. So working in public. And a lot of times folks are afraid to share the decisions that they are making or embarking on because they're worried, oh, I don't want to send the wrong signal. I don't want people to be confused about things. And so they withhold information and keep it behind that brick wall. And what ends up happening is that then nobody has any context about the decision. Nobody has any clue to what has happened. And we do that out of a sense of like paternalism and protection to like protect people from like too much information. But I want to offer that like the exact opposite is what we need to be leaning into and kind of pushing ourselves outside of our comfort zone to like announce in the Slack channel, hey, we're about to make a decision about how we are like compensating like regional directors or how we are, you know, like our sales bonuses. You know, my inbox is open if you have thoughts or perspectives on this. And so not necessarily inviting 100 people into a meeting, because we know that that practice is not truly inclusive. It's just sort of like inviting a lot of people who are not going to get a chance to say anything, but offering people meaningful ways to interact, like send me a message, DM me, share your information with me, or I'm going to be sending out a survey to gather perspectives on this thing. So making sure that you're working in public, and that can help really buffer against that bias that creeps in when you're working behind a closed door and you're not being held accountable to anybody.
Yeah.
So those are kind of my first two tips. There are like a million others, but
I love the idea of always of transparency. I think it's interesting how we as business leaders tend to often find ourselves in this position because we're trying to avoid discomfort, right? We're trying to avoid conflict. We're trying to move as fast as we can. And the reality is that, you know, that little bit of effort, just communicating up front, can help us avoid a lot of that discomfort and conflict later. It's just like, we're just moving the marker, really. And so I love that advice. I'm curious, like, what other, like, from a benefits perspective, like when we're looking at organizations trying to understand how they can be better about their decision-making processes. If you were to try to like put together a quick campaign or give people the sound bites they need to help, you know, drive this conversation within their organizations, like what are the benefits of really teasing this apart and understanding and prioritizing decision-making specifically?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first one that I always have to start with is better business outcomes. It's so obvious, but it's so important to recognize that we live in a world where information doesn't flow from the top of our organization down. Information is constantly being introduced to us, to folks that are at the edges of our organization, for the people who are next to our customers. Information, good, important data and information is coming in from all of these windows. So why is it that our decision-making flows from the top down? What happens is that there are people with really good data about what the customer wants who then are hamstrung and unable to make decisions because they don't have the authority to move that forward. How much more effective would your business be if the people who had the best information were the people that were driving decisions? So the first thing that I always say is like better business outcomes. I think a lot of other of the value of it is engagement, retention. People often cite feeling disempowered, not trusted as a reason for leaving an organization. So it's a great way to like share not only skill build, but also share power and authority and really give people autonomy over their lives, their work lives, which is something that we're all craving. And that is an incredible way to retain your great talent, to make sure that folks are happy and engaged. And then I think there are also just a host of downstream impacts, like more equitable organizations or more diverse organizations. They surface better ideas faster. They're able to act on those ideas and generate learning more quickly. And so your ability not just to create better outcomes, but to position yourself in the market, to adapt to unforeseen events, like COVID, for example, are so much more powerful when you have a good decision-making practice in place.
Absolutely. I think that's a really great context to look at the power of decision-making. It's just, you know, over the last few years, there have been so many very large, significant decisions that had to be made about changes in the way people work. And so many of those decisions in organizations around the world were made without feedback, without discussion, without anyone weighing in on how it would impact their day-to-day lives and their ability to do their job well. And I think that, you know, certainly in the side of collecting inclusion and exclusion data, we've been able to see that people are increasingly valuing recognition and just, you know, being able to contribute to the greater sense of, you know, the mission of the organization. And so, you know, it starts with being heard and being able to contribute and feeling like decisions aren't being made for you. But I do think that in the last couple of years, we've seen several of those examples play out, you know, around the
pandemic
and such.
And we're continuing to see it as we kind of question, like, do we need to go back to the office? Are people moving, you know, all of these discussions about how we work. And we all know that there are like a few loud voices, like the CEOs that are like, I want to see everybody back in the office, or I want, you know, folks to be able to collaborate. So there are a few loud voices that are sort of dominating that discussion. But have you checked in with your employees? Have you asked them what is their ideal work week? Sometimes we ask that question just to begin to sense like, okay, people really want to be in the office for these moments that matter, but for regular heads down desk time, they want to be remote. And being able to surface that information from your people is so powerful, because now you can create a policy or a whole, you know, suite of policies and reimbursements and incentives that align to what your employees actually want, rather than what a few people in power believe to be the right choice.
Yeah, absolutely. I am curious, you know, we've talked a lot about the need to approach decision-making with an equitable lens and with an inclusive and transparent, approach. And, I do believe that by changing the way we make decisions in an organization or just being more aware of how decisions are being made across our organization, that we can create more inclusive organizations. I'm curious if you have any, other recommendations or final notes around, what should folks be thinking about when it comes to decision making, what tools they should be paying attention to, or, where do they start with this work?
Yeah, I think I just want to underscore what you said, that decision making is an incredible way to observe and to shift power dynamics and equity in your organization. And so there's a lot of talk about being more inclusive workspaces, being more equitable, and decision making is a way to sort of walk the walk, right? To put authority into the hands of people who are typically not included in decision-making processes, or they don't hold that formal organizational authority. This is an opportunity to really shift power dynamics in a meaningful way, not just, not that there's anything wrong with adding ERGs or other initiatives or workshops. All of that stuff is great. But if you're not thinking about the structure and authority and power in your organization, then you are going to fall short of the goals that you have for yourself around equity and inclusion. So I just want to underscore that decision-making can be a really powerful tool to show your people and your teams that you are ready to fully embrace this and really give power to people when it matters, and not just when it's convenient or, a 2-hour workshop that everybody goes to and then it's back to business as usual. So I want to call that out. And I think my last suggestion would be, I think we've said it before, but I think it bears repeating, look at decision-making, map a critical decision that your team has made. Once you see it on paper, you will be able to so clearly see where you are in need of updating your processes or making your processes more clear or more inclusive. And just to recap it, I think the points along the spectrum that I would urge you to consider are, one, noticing when a decision gets made, how do we define decisions, what's in scope and out of scope. Stakeholder mapping is step 2. Picking a decision-making method, so not consensus or individual action, but one of those more participatory methods in the middle of that spectrum. And then finally, and importantly, communicating transparently about decision-making. If you can kind of map your process against those 4 stops, you're going to see a lot of opportunity to improve.
I love frameworks and lists. So that was the perfect recap for me, and hopefully other folks whose brain works similar to mine. I also just love the fact that we're able today through this conversation to kind of connect the dots between org design and decision-making and the ultimate goal of having an inclusive organization, and, kind of underscore the fact that creating a more inclusive organization, creating these more intentional decision-making practices is going to make your business more successful. It's going to help you retain the best talent. It's going to help you be a better organization, and it's going to help folks really lead into their roles on a day-to-day basis. And so there's a lot of benefits to come from this work. I hope that everyone, that this sparked a bit of curiosity, if nothing else. Maybe we'll all be Googling decision-making after this, me included. And that we can, be a resource to you all, should you want to learn more about both inclusion and measuring inclusion, but also everything that you all do with decision making, but also just broader org design. So maybe if you want to just leave us with a note on how folks can get a hold of you and find you and learn from you on an ongoing basis. Yeah.
Absolutely. A couple places you can find me. You can find me on LinkedIn, Alexis Gonzalez Black. You can find me on our company's website, which is aug.co, AUG.co, or you can email me directly if you're so bold. I would love to hear from you and hear your questions. I'm happy to engage in a conversation about this. Obviously, I nerd out on it. I love it. So feel free to reach out. It's agb@aug.co.
Amazing. And similarly, if you're looking to learn more about inclusion, you can find us at aleria.tech, aleria.tech. You can also find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, all the things. My email is lisa@aleria.tech as well. We are so thankful for your time, and we look forward to continuing the conversation, y'all. Take care.
Thank you again for listening to the Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to get updates on the latest episodes. Also, tell us what you think by reviewing our podcast. We'd love to hear your feedback. For more information, visit us at forumworkplaceinclusion.org or search Workplace Forum on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you very much and have a great day. The Forum on Workplace Inclusion podcast is recorded at Augsburg University in Minneapolis, Minnesota. One of the most diverse private colleges in the Midwest, Augsburg University offers more than 50 undergraduate majors and 9 graduate degrees to 3,000 students of diverse backgrounds at its campus in the vibrant center of the Twin Cities and nearby Rochester, Minnesota locations. Augsburg educates students to be informed citizens, thoughtful stewards, critical thinkers, and responsible leaders. At Augsburg, education is defined by excellence in the local arts and professional studies, guided by the faith and values of the Lutheran Church, and shaped by its urban and global settings. Learn more at augsburg.edu.